There's few of us here. Let me just double check who is not here. There seems to be few of us. I hope they haven't gone into the evening league.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Ben, so Stumbi, was I audible?
Hardly.
Oh, all right. Maybe let me start again. It's just load shedding in Kulun. Probably get worse in Nongo. Now, I was saying we are getting a briefing from the NPA and the Hawks this morning on matters related to PPE procurement and the investigations thereof. There was an additional request to the NPA on matters related to sign off, and albeit that it was sent late, I'd like to thank the NGPP for responding positively to that and willing to provide an update. And so, colleagues, I was saying we will be in the hands of the NPA and the Hawks, and they will make their presentation and they will give guidance to us as to who starts. And then we will take questions when both presentations have been made. The other matters which we have to deal with about tonight, can we deal with those at the end or during the day? So to the NDPP and the head of the Hawks, good morning and welcome to you and your teams. And we are in your hands. And we welcome the SIU who are also present in the city.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Thank you again for this opportunity for us as law enforcement entities to account to Parliamentary Committee SCOPA. Chair, perhaps the way to proceed would be I will introduce my team, and then perhaps General Labia as well as Advocate Mutibi, if he's on, will introduce his teams. The way we will present today, Chair, is that we are required to present on three things, Chair. That's the COVID-19 corruption cases, cases relating to corruption in SOEs, and of course the Steinhoff matter was added. Chair, with regard to COVID-19 corruption cases, these matters are managed in the Fusion Center under the auspices of the Anti-Corruption Task Team. And General Labia, as the chair of the ACTT, will do the presentation, a joint presentation, because we work in a collaborative way in the Fusion Center, will present a joint presentation on that. He will also, so that deals with the COVID-19 corruption matters. And then we have the SOEs, and then, of course, there's, with regard to the SOEs, there are matters that are being managed in the DPCI, Specialized Commercial Crimes Unit in the NPA, and AFU. Well, AFU cuts straddles across all of them. But with regard to SOE matters, there's some that are being managed in the DPCI together with the NPA SCCU, Specialized Commercial Crime Units. And then, of course, there are those that are being managed in the Investigating Directorate. So with regard to the SOEs corruption, General Labia will also, that will be included in his presentation when he starts. After his presentation, Advocate Cronier, the Investigating Director of the Investigating Directorate in the NPA, will present the ID part. Chair, let me quickly then, with that brief outline, introduce the NPA team, Chair. And I hope they are online, because for some reason, well, let me check the participant. I outline that if colleagues can please confirm that they are. They should be Advocate Descock, who is the Deputy National Director of Public Prosecutions, in charge of the National Prosecuting Service and the Specialized Commercial Crime Unit. So they report directly to Advocate Cock. He is here with Advocate Lebo Baloy, who is the recently appointed Special Director of the SCCU. And then with me is in the boardroom here is Advocate Omar Rabaji Rastava, and maybe I can just, she is present. Omar, if you could just greet the committee.
Good morning, Chairperson and committee members. I'm Omar Rabaji. I'm the head of Asset Forfeiture Unit. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that, Omar. And then Chair with her is Advocate Priya Vistestwa, who is also a Special Director recently appointed of the Asset Forfeiture Unit. And then we also have Advocate Bezenhout, I'm forgetting your first name, please forgive, Peter Bezenhout, who is the Acting Regional Head of the Asset Forfeiture Unit in Pretoria. And Chair, also present is my Special Advisor, Advocate Ntunzi Mahaga. And then, of course, I'm hoping that Advocate Cronier is online. And so if I could please ask Advocate Cock and Advocate Cronier to confirm that you are online.
I am.
And then, thank you. Thank you, Hermione. And Rodney, are you there?
NDPP, Advocate Dikoki is still having a bit of a challenge connecting, but he will join. He will join eventually. Thank you. But I am here.
And that is Advocate Lebo Baloy, the Special Director in the SCCU.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lebo. Chair, that is the NPA team. I hope I'm not leaving anyone out. And I will hand over to General Labia. Thank you, Chair, through you, of course.
No, that's fine. Thank you very much, NDP. I think the outline you've given is fine. For this, General Labia will introduce the team, and then we'll dive right into the presentation to proceed within the parameters that have been indicated. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. Also, good morning to the colleagues from the ACTT. Honorable Chairperson, from the DPCI side, I am leading the team. I am joined by the Deputy National Head of the DPCI, which is Lieutenant General Musigili. I'm also joined by the head of serious commercial crime, who's also acting as the component head of the commercial crime environment, which is Brigadier Makinyani. The others are administrative staff that are assisting the colonels and the captains who are sitting with me. Chairperson, we have also invited other colleagues that have got interest that may assist in entertaining the questions where we are jointly dealing with these matters, especially in the fusion center. The Honorable Chairperson will see that there are representatives from the SARS, from the other partners that we work with, from the SAPS, which are also dealing with the investigation. We have Major General Maxson, who is representing the crime detection as the Deputy National Commissioner, is also at the same time participating in the Portfolio Committee on Police. As the NDPP has indicated, the presentation is joint, and we will be presenting a joint version that is applicable to all, and then they will just be assisting with the answering of the specific questions. We are just trying to load it, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm not sure if we seem to be struggling to go to the full screen. Is it on full screen, Chairperson?
No, it's not on my end. I don't know, colleagues. I suppose colleagues can zoom into it and see, but you also have it. And so just proceed, and whilst you proceed, you can try so we can manage our time. Thanks, General. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson.
General, if I may, yeah, we can see. So it doesn't look like it's at the beginning. It's a fellow, unless that's where you started.
Are we able to see? That is where I'm starting. Is that on full screen?
It's not on full screen, but as the chair said, General, perhaps you can proceed.
All right. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, the presentation will be also pointing the matters that are handled by the SIU, NPA, DPCI, with specific reference to the SOE and the COVID-19 related corruption cases. It seems that it might not be moving. Are we all on the second screen? The Chairperson, we just want to...
General, let's give you and your team some 2 minutes to sort this out.
All right.
So, colleagues, can we just continue a bit patient whilst these technicalities are sorted out? Would Ben please assist?
Okay.
Thank you. And General, to assist you from our side, we can see from slide 34. So just to let you know that.
Okay. You can assist the MDPP. We'll wait a bit until it's sorted.
Thank you, Chair.
You say it's light, huh?
General, if you look at the bottom right of your screen, there's a sliding scale there from 0 to 100. It's presently on 56. So if you can tap on the plus sign to increase the size.
Are you winning?
General, can you tap on the left where you have thumbnails? We are currently on 36. So if you want 35, you can tap on 35, 34, and so on, or slide up and down to get to the screen you wish to. Yeah, that's it. Now, I don't know how it appears from your side, but normally at the bottom of the document, you would have a slider, which if you slide left or right, will shift the document left or right. Because right now, the document starts at wherever it starts, and then we can't see the... Oh, yeah, we can see it now if you remove the panel on the right showing the participants. Okay, that seems to be in order. Yeah, looks like it's in order now.
All right. But Ben, let's do this. Can you just share the presentation and you will assist? We'll let you know in terms of when you want to move to the next page so we can manage time.
Okay, let me get rid of that.
Rather you do that. Share it from your end. And then general, you will indicate to put present and when it does and when you need them to move to the next slide.
Just give me some time while I locate it. Tommy, what date was this sent? I can't minimize my screen as a host. Can you just remind me what date this was so I can access it from the email itself?
Let me check, Ben.
Okay.
Oh, I think we are, because the first slides deal with mandates and things, and we can just go through that fairly quickly.
All right, that's Thanks. Fine.
Chair, this is the later part. It's not this. Slides. This is for the ID, which comes much later.
Let's take what's available right now whilst we fix this problem, because we're really losing time.
Let me ask if Ed will be ready to proceed then. Damien?
Yes, I am.
Chair, do you propose that she starts then?
Yeah, that's fine. It's all one standard. It will come together at the end. It's all right.
Okay. All right.
All right, let's get the ID. Have a pitch, Konya.
I'm just trying to... So do I have... can I share my screen? Or do I just...
I think, Hermione, the screen is being shared, so it might best be better to go with this and then ask the person to change, because we might end up with another drama.
Okay.
Thanks.
Sure. So I can only, I can't see very much myself, but let me proceed. Thank you, honorable members. This is my first time in Skopje, so I think I'll take a little bit of time just to explain the role of the investigating directorate. The ID was established in March 2019 by presidential proclamation. The president had it in his SONA address a month earlier, announced his wish to establish an investigating directorate in the Office of the National Director of Public Prosecutions. And the announcement came in response to the revelations of corruption, and certainly the allegations of corruption that were being exposed as the State Capture Commission at the time. What the investigating directorate is an effort to bring together all the capability within law enforcement under one roof. So it has the power to investigate, to prosecute, and to recover assets. Obviously, it shares these powers with other law enforcement agencies. So the police and the Hawks have the power to investigate the NPA. Other units like the SACU and the DPP's offices have the power to prosecute, and the asset forfeiture unit has civil recovery powers. But the ID has those powers in one place, under one roof, as it were. Ideally, all these powers should be co-located. All these people in a multidisciplinary team are meant to be co-located and focused on dealing with, in our case, serious, high-profile, and complex corruption. So that is what the mandate of the ID is. It is to address serious, high-profile, and complex corruption, and the offences that the ID is entitled to investigate and prosecute are specified in the proclamation, and they include, obviously, offences under the Prevention of Corruption Act, the Prevention of Organised Crime Act, and common law offences such as fraud and other statutory offences, including money laundering and racketeering. So that generally is the mandate of the ID. I don't know if the slides are moving along. But if we could go
we're on the second slide now, Hermione. Can you not see it? We're on the organogram.
Yes, I see it now. So I've just put up the organogram there to give members an indication of, it's certainly aspirational. But what the ID is not a separate organization. It is a capability, and the idea is to bring together all these skills and deploy them to particular problems, as it were, particular focus areas. So when I was appointed in May 2019, it is my job to go and recruit and bring people together to work on these cases. And Section 7 of the NPA Act is the mechanism that was afforded the ID to recruit. So the main mechanism there is to recruit people from within the NPA and have them reassigned from their current jobs to focus on ID matters. Similarly, I went to the Hawks and SAPS to have seconded or placed on duty arrangements members of the Hawks and SAPS to, with their powers, be deployed to work on these cases. And then I was authorized to second people from organizations like the SIU, like SARS, like the Reserve Bank, the Treasury, and various organizations where the skill to work on these matters are located and bring them together. Initially, it became very clear that there were very serious skills shortages throughout the criminal justice value chain, and we would have to rely on more than just secondments to capacitate the ID. We then obtained a deviation from DPSA to allow us to recruit additional to our
our establishment, the NPA establishment, personnel on contract for 3 years. And I can report that at the beginning of this year, in January 2021, we had our first cohort of 21 financial investigators begin. And that delay had something to do with the fact that when the Scorpions were relocated to the SAPS, there was no longer provision to appoint investigators in the NPA. And there was some difficulty around then getting posts additional to the NPA establishment for financial investigator posts. But those issues have now been resolved, and we have 21 financial investigators deployed. The next challenge then is to make sure that they have the resources, the tools of the trade, to be able to do their work. And that is also something that has finally been resolved, in that the State Capture Commission has amassed quite a sophisticated digital forensics lab, which will move over to support the work of the ID and to equip the financial investigators that have been appointed to do the work. So that is just how we've come together as a group of people. The way we've divided up the work is what you can see on the second slide. We're trying to build the capability in the black slide, so the capability to do digital forensic work and commercial forensic work, and just basic investigator and legal support. And you know, for us, coordination with our stakeholders is critical, because every matter we take on, we call together all our stakeholders and make sure that we understand who's doing what and how we can best tackle whatever the particular problem is. We've divided our work up into three focus areas, as you'll see at the bottom. And the first is sort of a public and private sector corruption. The middle block is the state-owned enterprises. And at the end, we have the security sector focus area. So today we'll just talk about the SOE focus area. If we go to the next slide, I've just listed the powers that the Act gives to members of the investigating directorate. So members of the directorate have the power to subpoena witnesses, to furnish documents, or to answer questions. We have the power to apply for and execute search and seizure warrants. We have the power to compel witnesses to answer questions under oath, including self-incriminating questions, obviously subject to them, subject to us not using that information to prosecute them. And then we are able to prosecute those cases after consultation with the relevant DTT, in whose area we will be enrolling the prosecution. And then we have the ability to bring asset forfeiture applications. But I should add that through the secondment arrangement entered into with our partners, police officers assigned from the police, for example, come with police powers, but have to perform those powers subject to the police policies and procedures. But they are directed by members of the ID in the day-to-day work that they do. If we move to the next slide, I've listed there what led to the authorization of investigations at Transnet and Eskom, which at the moment are the two major state-owned enterprises that we have authorized investigations in respect of. The first was the report of the erstwhile public protector, the state of capture report dated 14 October. We've looked at testimony led at the State Capture Commission, alleging serious and high-level corruption within state-owned enterprises, particularly those relating to Eskom and Transnet. And then there were a number of ongoing criminal investigations into unlawful activities committed at Eskom and Transnet, relating to serious and high-level corruption. And I should just point out there that much of the alleged unlawful activity resulted in people opening dockets all over the country. So there are many police dockets, many of them opened by members of parliament relating to certain aspects. And I think it's important to use as an example to illustrate the way in which the ID works differently. So normally a police officer will get an A1 statement, a complainant statement, where allegations of an offence are set out under oath. And that police officer has to determine, is there a reasonable suspicion that an offence was committed, and investigate further if the allegations do disclose a reasonable suspicion. What the ID does is, the ID, in terms of the Act, can take on matters referred by any member of the public, but it has to fall within the mandate as defined by the President in the proclamation, but also the Director has a discretion. And very often, one complainant statement will have one piece of the puzzle, but they will often be a number of dockets that we consolidate and look at holistically to see if we can understand the picture more comprehensively. So there were a number of criminal case dockets that had been opened that we drew into our investigations into Eskom and Transnet. And then we did also receive reports in terms of Section 27 of the NPA Act, which is a particular entity writing to the directorate and saying, you know, we have reason to believe offences were committed. We believe those offences fall within the mandate of the ID, and we ask that you investigate further. So, in the context of Eskom, I thought I would spell out just the broad focus area. And as I said earlier, it is my first time at SCOPA, and it is a challenge to speak about ongoing investigations, especially ones where, you know, those matters haven't been, the individuals who are implicated have not been charged, so they don't know the charges are faced against them. I mean, the challenge is not just that we would then be infringing their rights, but we would also be disclosing and revealing, you know, the scope of our investigations. The reason I decided we probably should disclose the scope of what we are looking at here is that many of these allegations are already in the public domain, and it's certainly not a secret that they are being addressed by the directorate. And in fact, much of what we are looking at here has already been addressed in the public domain. So in relation to the Transnet, for example, it's very much in the public domain because not only has Transnet filed papers before court applying to review and set aside the award of the 1064 locomotives tender, there are several other pieces of litigation going on in relation to that tender. And of course, there has been evidence led at the Zondo Commission where allegations have been leveled. So we are looking at the 1064 locomotives contract. We are looking at the relocation of the two original manufacturers, equipment manufacturers, the OEMs, and then we're also looking at, it's no secret, the consulting and advisory contracts. And the reason why that's no secret is, if you move to the next slide, we went to court in November 2019 in relation to that transaction advisory contract, and we brought a restraint application against Regiments Capital, which is one of the contractors with Transnet in the transaction advisory services. We went to court on the basis that regiment's capital and associated persons like its three directors and shareholders and related companies were involved in corruption and money laundering scheme relating to Transnet and the second defined benefit fund, which is a Transnet pension fund. And secondly, we alleged in those papers that the defendants had entered into agreements with persons associated with the Gupta family, particularly one Salim Essa, to the effect that Essa and his associates would facilitate the appointment of regiment's companies by Transnet or the fund, among other state-owned entities, where they would provide financial services for grossly inflated fees. So in terms of this order, approximately 1.6 billion was restrained. In addition, 600 million was released or returned to the Transnet Second Defined Benefit Fund. Unfortunately, on 26 October 2020, Mahlelo J. discharged the provisional restraint order on the basis of material non-disclosure. The judge felt that that we had failed to disclose a settlement agreement between the members of regiments, and we had failed to disclose a settlement agreement that had been entered into between regiments, capital, and Transnet in relation to the same unlawful activities that we were dealing with. We have been granted leave to appeal the decision on the basis that the documents that were not disclosed, in our view, were not material to granting the restraint order. We also felt that the non-disclosure did not warrant the discharge of the provisional restraint order, and it best ought to have impacted only on the quantum, on the value. If the Transnet settlement was relevant, well, then the appropriate relief would be to reduce the 1.6 billion by the some 200 million that settlement related to. And then he said that the court's finding that it was not for the NPA's deponent to pick and choose what to include in a restraint application is unrealistic. In complex matters, and this particular matter is incredibly complex and incredibly voluminous, there inevitably has to be a selection process. If this is not done, the judge would be utterly overwhelmed by the volume of evidence. So this is a significant issue for us. It was our first foray into the court. If we had placed before court everything in our possession, as we will be obliged to do when we proceed to criminal trial, we have to discover all the evidence that we've collected, the court would not be in a position to process that evidence in any meaningful way because it is just too voluminous. So that matter is being appealed, and the appeal will be heard in hopefully the second quarter of this year. But for us, it's a significant matter because it will make it very difficult in any big matter to obtain a restraint order, because inevitably there will be decisions made about what is placed before court and what's not, and the consequences if a document is not disclosed, we would submit should be different than in when it's an ordinary litigant. So what the effect of the court's order was is that the 1.6 billion in assets that we had under restraint was released from the restraint order. However, there had already been a prior application to liquidate regiments from its major creditors, and SARS joined that litigation in respect of at least 48 million rands worth of unpaid taxes. But SARS was at the beginning of its investigation into unpaid taxes on the part of regiments. And so that the assets were still under restraint, as I understand it. But the state does not have control of those assets at this point. The commitment by McKinsey to repay Transnet in excess of 600 million at the State Capture Commission in relation to its involvement in the transaction advisory contracts, together with regiments, will further augment recovery of assets under the transaction advisory agreement. So we work very closely with SARS, with the SIU, with Transnet, as well as with the State Capture Commission in trying to ensure that holistically we are addressing using all the capabilities at the state's disposal to ensure that we recover those assets. At the same time, in November 2019, in relation to regiments, we obtained a search and seizure warrant to take control of the regiment server and a range of other digital devices, computers, cell phones, of many of the people who worked there. And as we said in our restraint papers, and a restraint order obviously requires us to show that we are about to charge or have charged people in relation to which to the criminal activity we allege the assets or the proceeds of. We informed the court at that stage that there were two issues holding up finalization of the charge sheet in that matter. The first was the execution of the search warrant and extracting the data, extracting relevant data off the regiment server, as well as a forensic report that would set out the financial flows from Transnet to regiments and then to the shell companies, the numerous shell companies that the funds were transferred into afterwards before they ultimately ended up in the hands, in this particular case, on our papers, Salim Essa and Moodley. In the Moodley application, we have also obtained a restraint order over the assets held by Moodley, and that restraint order has since been confirmed. The forensic report, which was the forensic company was appointed before the ID was established by National Treasury and the DPCI, and the report was due by March 2020. We've only recently received the report, and the prosecutors are of the view that they would not be able to enroll a matter based on the quality of that work, and so we have had to redo it. Also, the finalization of accessing documents from the regiment server has been complicated by the fact that regiments have alleged that among the server, the material on the server, there are documents that are legally privileged, and this sparked off an engagement that took some 6 months to resolve as to how we were going to agree to release legally privileged material and retain access to the rest of the material that was relevant to our investigation. That issue was further complicated by the fact that regiments then went into liquidation and couldn't pay for this work to be done, for their legally privileged material to be extracted. We've resolved that issue now, and we have access to the server and are in a document review process sifting through that material for material relevant to our investigation. And so after a whole range of difficulties, the transaction advisory charge sheet is expected to take a further 3 months to complete, based on where we stand now. As regards the 1064 locomotives contract, the SIU on the 9th of March, together with Transnet, brought an application to review and set aside the contracts awarded to the four OEMs, General Electric, Bombardier, China South Rail, and China North Rail. So the contract valued at $54 billion in 2014 was set aside on the basis that the procurement was based on a flawed market demand strategy, and that the laws, government instructions, and Transnet policy was deliberately ignored. the OEMs were not entitled to benefit from the locomotive supply agreements that were awarded to them in an irregular and an illegal manner, and particularly not when the manufacturers conducted themselves in the manner that China South Rail and China North Rail conducted themselves. Transnet and the SIU's case was that General Electric and Bombardier could not claim that they did not or could not reasonably have known that the procurement process and subsequent contracts were irregular and unlawful. Now, this application was many, many months in the making. It sets out comprehensively the wrongdoing at Transnet. So the founding affidavit alone is over 800 pages, and the annexures go into many, many Levarch files. The application is based on the extraction and analysis of over 29 million documents. What this has done has set out under oath, chapter and verse, what was irregular and wrong about the award of the contract. That assists our investigation, as it clearly identifies the individuals who played a role in that contract being awarded irregularly. But that's not enough. You know, what we have to show is that those who were involved in the irregular or unlawful award of those contracts did so for an ulterior purpose. And the best way to show that is, of course, if we can show those people involved derived benefits, or those people involved colluded with other parties who derived benefits. But what the Transnet and SIU application does is give us that solid foundation to move into the next phase, which is following the money from when it leaves Transnet and moves to its ultimate destination. And in the 1064 locomotives case, the Transnet application together with the SARS application in December 2020. Now, the SARS application in 2020, December, was based on seizing $2.8 billion in funds held to the credit of CRRC, eLoco. CRRC is a successor entitled to China South Rail and China North Rail. They have amalgamated and they now trade as CRRC. The $2.8 billion is being held on the basis that it is the proceeds of the corrupt deal that took place in the 1064 contract award. On the basis that it has since come to light that there have been these what we called bribe agreements, in terms of which offshore company in Hong Kong owned by Salim Esser received kickbacks of 20% and 21%. All of this is set out in the and is before court in these applications, the first and the second applications. In order for an indictment to be finalized in relation to the 1064 contract based on admissible evidence, is the financial flows to prove that the money flowed, to prove the authenticity of the bribe agreement, that we are dependent on mutual legal assistance. But I am happy to report that we are making progress on that, and that we are not far from being able to pull together the various loose strands, even in holding accountable in court those responsible for the corruption in the award of the 1064 locomotive project. So I quickly want to move on to the ESCOM matters, because I presume there'll be questions on the Transnet one later. In the ESCOM matter, we have broken up the overarching investigation into a number of sub investigations. Many of them, again, has been evidence has been led at the Zondo Commission, and litigation is being pursued in relation to aspects. In Eskom, we have brought before court under Bedford View CAS 354 and Paula CAS 125 an application relating to the award of contracts at Kusile power station. And we have before court the following accused, Franz Lakudi, Lakudi Translation and Bond Service Telecom. These are entities through which funds were laundered in the indictment as it now stands. And Tubular Construction Project is the entity that paid the bribe for the award of the contract. This matter is before court. We have applied for the extradition of Mike Lomas, who is also an accused in this matter. I think Avram Masango is also an accused in this matter. And the matter has been postponed to 1 June for the state to reply to an application for further particulars and for the extradition process to be finalized. So that one is in hand.
I mean, I think the slides are not moving with you, so I think you should be now on slide 4.
I'm on slide 12, actually.
Oh, well, what is
I'm not moving on. Sorry.
We are still, I don't know if it's just me, but I'm seeing the very busy slide with the orange and the blue.
So if we can move to slide 13, which is the one I just spoke to about the one set of matters relates to the decommissioning of the turbine generator units at Kusile. So we have an investigation into the corruption attendant on that decommissioning. And I was saying in relation to slide 13, that's a status update of a matter that is before court already. And then 14 refers to, I don't know if it's moving. Are the slides moving?
What's the heading on the slide, Hermian?
I'm on 14 now.
Okay. So that one is Eskom Kusile Tubular.
That's right.
That's right.
So as I was saying, these slides relate to the decommissioning at Kusile, and there are a number of instances of corruption of corrupt contractors paying bribes that arise from that investigation. I think there's a duplication actually between 13 and 14. So if we can go to 15, and this is the investigation into allegations of fraud, theft, corruption, and money laundering, and contraventions of the PFM Public Finance Management Act. In relation to a whole range of individuals at Eskom during in relation to Tegeta Exploration and Resources and the purchase of shares held in Optimum Coal Mine by Tegeta. This matter, a forensic investigation had commenced prior to the establishment of the directorate, which we then took over. Unfortunately, the contract was held by Treasury, and Treasury's tender came to an end in March last year, and contractors weren't paid to conclude their work. We've now taken over the contract and are managing delivery of the product of this investigation. And it is significantly far advanced. And it is in the drafting of charges stage. And enrollment is also anticipated, certainly in the first 6 months of this year. There are two smaller aspects of that case that will be enrolled sooner. The next case that we've been dealing with is the ABB contract awarded by Eskom for the control and instrumentation at contract at Kusile Power Station. ABB,
the slide I think needs to move. What number are you on now? Yeah, I think that's it. Yes, I think that's the ABB one. Go ahead.
So working with the SIU and ESCOM, ABB has self-reported its role and involvement in the corrupt award of this contract. And as a result of our engagements with ABB, ABB concluded an agreement with ESCOM and the SIU in December last year, in terms of which ESCOM would be paid back 1.6 billion rand as well. This matter is in fact ready. We have had excellent cooperation from ABB, but for which we would not have been in a position to uncover what we have uncovered. In particular, email and cell phone communications between ABB senior executives and senior executives at ESCOM. We have had to bring an application for mutual legal assistance in Switzerland and Germany because the release of this data to us is governed by EU data protection laws. And so as soon as we have authority from those law enforcement agencies in Switzerland and Germany, we are able to finalize our indictment, effect arrest, hand over our dockets, and place these matters on the roll for trial. So if we can move to the next slide. I just wanted to give members a sense of why these matters take so long. There is general recognition that when you're focusing at high level, at the top end of the spectrum, you're dealing with senior politicians, you're dealing with multinational organizations and senior executives in those organizations who have the ability to camouflage and conceal the efforts to engage in corruption. And, you know, on the law enforcement end, we don't have the professionals to match that level of sophistication. You know, the complexity, you know, we just don't have the skills equal to. So each of these contracts, the 1064 locos contract, you know, coal supply contracts, instrumentation, the CNI contract at ESCOM, these are complex commercial arrangements. And to identify unlawful activity in that and attribute that unlawful activity to the people in control, when often the law gives those individuals the discretion to make these complex decisions, is a very difficult matter. And that's why the collaboration is essential with leadership in the SOEs, because it's very difficult for law enforcement to go in there and work out what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. You know, investigators and lawyers are just not equipped to make those assessments. So we've relied heavily on expert witness opinion to enable us to work out where the wrongdoing occurred. So as I said, these cases involve not only senior politicians and senior executives in multinationals, but there are supported by teams of accountants and lawyers and management consulting firms that help them disguise what they were doing. And so when you are faced with the criminal standard of beyond reasonable doubt, and you have to be able to persuade a court that you are relying on admissible evidence, the challenge is enormous. But I have to point out that our biggest challenge to date has been around the data involved in these dockets. I've said terabytes of data, but I think we've moved well beyond terabytes. I was talking to colleagues at the commission, and they are talking about a petabyte of data. In order to do these investigations, we not only have to be able to move swiftly through vast volumes of contracts and tender documents, but we also have reams and reams of bank records. You know, every bank statement you get, there would be another 30 bank statements that money was transferred into, and then you have to follow up those. Cell phone records, you have one person's cell phone and you have to connect that person with five other people who are part of a bid adjudication committee or part of a meeting. So cell phone records and then emails, you know, getting hold of a server and then trawling through that server for relevant emails that disclose the true intention of the parties. And often, you know, they're operating two or three different email accounts in order to hide what they're doing. The sheer volume of the data that investigators are being saddled with and the sheer volume of material that prosecutors have to get on top of in order to extract sustainable charges is the challenge. And which is why towards the end of last year, when we managed to reach agreement with the State Capture Commission to use the sophisticated technology that the commission had been able to amass to sift through this data, has been a huge boost because it means we have the capability within the state. We're not dependent on private contractors to do this work, and that, you know, our work is prioritized. That is really the game changer in these complex investigations. So I want to use the opportunity to just list some of our key challenges, and that is skilled, capable investigators equal to the scale and scope of the investigations we're dealing with. You know, the operation that we sit with is dependent on secondments from law enforcement partners who themselves have dire shortages. We're dependent on temporary contractors who, you know, are always looking over their shoulders for a better opportunity, a more secure and permanent opportunity. So in our short life, we've had significant turnover of personnel already. We can't, you know, the NPA Act does not make provision for the appointment of investigators. We, you know, have dire skill shortages within the NPA and outside of the NPA, and our recruitment processes are just not keeping pace. Then, you know, we have obtained deviations to help us recruit skills, especially as people who have worked at the Commission for State Capture, the PIC Commission, and even the SARS Commission, as these people have experience with the subject matter, and so that also has speeded up. And then getting the digital and commercial investigation capability from the Zonder Commission has been key. But of course, the Zonder Commission is still also using that capability, so it really will only free up towards the three-month extension. So those are some of our challenges. I didn't put my number one challenge is we don't yet all sit in one building. We haven't been able to come together with all our people and our capability and implement the model in the way that it should be implemented. But I'm assured that as of the 1st of April, the 5th, because April 1 is April Fool's Day, we will be able to sit in a building and have all our experts in one place applied to resolving the matters that we have. So I wait for questions, but that's my contribution.
Thank you. Thank you, Herman. Thank you, Chair. I think perhaps we can, through you, Chair, it's up to you how you would like to proceed if General Labia is ready.
Chair? Mr. Chairman?
I don't know if the chair has been able to reconnect. His future has connection problems. I don't think he's been able to reconnect yet.
If that is the case, then can we, on his behalf, on behalf of colleagues here, identify those who want to ask the questions from the report. Thank you very much for the report, a very extensive report. If members have some questions to ask, are free to do so. Questions here. People have raised their hands. Honourable Benedicta and Honourable Mente.
Can I go ahead, Chair?
Yes, please, Honourable Member.
Thank you very much. I really want to say thank you for the very comprehensive report. I think there's a great deal here that needs unpacking. I have two questions. One is the issue of the settlement agreement with regiments. This is a question that I have asked the SIU several times. I have been concerned about the effect of settlement agreements on litigation and on criminal proceedings. If you could just expand on what happened in that judgment that you mentioned, and the role of settlement agreements vis-a-vis it potentially having an effect on successful criminal prosecutions and on litigation. And the second question is regarding your challenges, particularly being in the same building, being able to hire sufficient people with sufficient skills. There does exist in government, not just here, but across the world, the ability to frustrate intentions through bureaucratic barriers. The challenges you have, are there in fact being attempts to resolve that, or is there a potential indication that it is also bureaucratic barriers that are being put up to essentially hobble successful investigations? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Prime Minister. Can we take those questions and respond to them?
Thank you, Chair. I'll deal with the first one, and I'm not sure if the NDPP would want to deal with the second one, but I'll certainly have an answer. In relation to the settlement agreement, regiments and Transnet had entered into an agreement to settle a portion or settle the claim that Transnet had in relation to overpayments made to regiments. And I stand to be corrected, but I think the settlement was 240 million rand. Our investigation was based on the fact that the entire award of the contract, the transaction advisory contracts to regiments, was unlawful. And so we felt that the entire 1.6 billion rand that had been paid over to regiments was recoverable. We in court felt that the settlement agreement between Transnet and regiments was not relevant to our agreement, just like when someone steals money from their employer and separately reaches an agreement to repay whatever they've stolen. for us, that is separate from our ability to recover the proceeds of the crime. And so we felt that it wasn't relevant to disclose, and mainly because we had no knowledge of what influenced the settlement, what factors were taken into account, because all we had was a one-pager that said, in full and final settlement, regiments will pay Transnet, I stand under correction, 240 million rand. The court didn't agree with us. The court felt that we ought to have disclosed and that it was relevant to a restraint amount how much Transnet believed was due to it. And that's the issue that's currently on appeal, because we maintain whatever the reasons were, and there could be commercial considerations involved there and who knows what other considerations, but that strictly speaking, the court had to rule on the evidence we put before it to show it that the entire 1.6 billion was the proceeds of corruption. And we were simply non-suited because we didn't disclose the regiment's settlement. So our views, as a rule, they shouldn't impact on our case. But the court felt otherwise, and that's why we're taking the issue on appeal. In relation to bureaucratic difficulties, you're absolutely correct. The world over, you know, in order to comply with prescripts, you have to jump through a number of hurdles. And, you know, dealing with multi-billion rand contracts and seeing the importance of complying with these procedures obviously brings home to us the importance of going through these processes. But, you know, and in a country and an environment where there is so much concern about how rampant and rife corruption is, if you are fighting corruption, you are held to a very high standard in terms of how you procure. And we are trying to comply, but it does significantly hamper. And these rules are not flexible. So this morning I was just in a meeting to try and approve payment of a contract that had overrun because of the legal process through no fault of ours. But, you know, to get the procurement processes to interact with that complexity is what's often frustrating. I have not certainly laid any charges against anyone for frustrating procurement processes, but I certainly have come close. But that's not because there's objectively criminality there, but the processes are hugely frustrating. But I think the NDPP will comment.
It's just very quickly, if I can just add to that, I think that has been one of the biggest challenges, is dealing with very stringent procurement processes that need to be complied with. And unlike some other entities in government that have the ability to procure services at higher rates than the NPA, we have been really struggling with that. But I'm hoping that with the appointment of the new Deputy National Director, Advocate Duplessis, in charge of strategy, operations and compliance, as well as the new Director General in the Department of Justice, Advocate Doc Mashabane, that they will find legal but perhaps a little more creative ways of dealing with these hurdles, because the ability to quickly resource and capacitate the ID is of utmost importance in the coming. It always has been, but there have been serious challenges in the past 2 years. I'm certainly hoping that there will be. I also spoke to the minister. We had a meeting just earlier this week, and I've spoken to him previously, but just this week, about perhaps even looking at the necessity to create some kind of meeting between himself and other ministers that could assist in government support from other departments to the ID. But hopefully things will change. But it has been a difficult process. Thank you, Chair.
Chair's back. Chairperson?
I am, but maybe you can proceed. My network is a bit unstable.
Okay. Honorable Benedicta, are you satisfied with the
well, I was just here, the no,
answer?
But
yes,
I should be stable now, but just proceed because you know where we are, okay?
I am, very much.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Honorable Mente?
Thank you, Chair. I only have one question. I just want to first state the following. As much as we are seeing the report and what's been done, the primary task of the NPA is to ensure successful prosecution of corrupt individuals in this case. Now, if we do not get people behind bars and we forever having cases that are ongoing at court, and we don't, at the end of the day, make any impact where corruption is concerned, this is going to be an endless chain. I would think that in this year alone, the SIU has had almost over 50 referrals on the issues of PPE. And then there are issues of the SOEs that are quite a number of cases. Now I'm sitting thinking, Chair, are we ever going to make an impact? That's the concern I have. Can the NDPP tell us if we can ever make an impact on this? And then my question is, out of these cases, we can see the dates that are here. Let me just make an example with the Eskom cases. Eskom cases is a Bedford View, case 354 of 8, 2017. 2021, the case is still on the roll. We haven't been given a complete status in terms of the case, but the time frame on its own is concerning. Do we then, NDPP, do we then have cases that we can report they are near finalization and they have a positive, successful prosecution? Out of the cases that were reported 2020 backwards, leave 2021, 2020 backwards, can we get just five cases that you say these ones we've put people behind bars and on these ones we are successful in terms of the prosecution? Because the matter now that we have, Chair, is that you would see they are complaining, rightfully so, that it's difficult to get hold of certain people, and the procurement processes, those that manipulate procurement processes, they have a tendency of resigning when they see that they are in a corner. But what's most important is that those individuals are still South Africans, they are still within South Africa, we can get them anywhere they are. And therefore, we have only one option to punish them, is the criminal procedure, because under disciplinary procedure they escape it through resigning, and in many a times we can't even recoup what we have from them because their pension would have been taken as well. Now my problem is, are we getting anywhere? Because if we still have a case that's still on the roll since 2017, and is still on the road. And in terms of its current status, there isn't much promising that we are getting to a finalization of a case. Thank you, Chair.
Sharaj, do you want to respond to the question?
Yes.
That's a matter. I'll ask Advocate Punya to deal with that. But Chair, and in, with regard to cases, you know, that have been dealt with, I think just to explain that these are, what we've had a presentation on now is only the ID matters. And these are the very, very complex corruption matters that, in fact, if we get cases to court within 2 to 3 years, we are doing extremely well. And after that, if these matters get finalized in a year or two, I think that is really doing extremely well, because, you know, what happens even once a court is enrolled with various applications, these cases take extremely long. So I think it's really important to make the point that when you're looking at people at the top of this highly complicated ladder and web of corruption, it takes extremely long. But on the other cases, you asked for particular cases prior to 2020, I'm going to ask that my colleagues online in the SCCU deal with that. But Chair, just in terms of, and generally I can answer that impact, Chair, you know, I think no one more than us in law enforcement knows, and particularly in the prosecuting authority, knows and understands the importance of making impact on the cases that we take to court. And are we ever going to make impact? That was the question. And my answer is yes, we will. We have no option. And I know I sound like a stuck record when I talk about resources. And outside of the ID, the cases that are in the specialized commercial crime unit space, and there are a number of cases in that space that have been finalized, there we work with the DPCI. And there's many high-profile cases that are sitting in that space. And there's a lot that's happening in that space to deal with this. I don't know that I should go into the detail now, because in terms of the presentation, we were meant to, I'm happy to deal with it later, but Chair, through you, in terms of the presentation, and some of these matters may be covered in the presentation that's going to follow, because the SOE matters that are falling outside of the directorate is part of the presentation that's going to be covered by General Libia. So I would ask Chair, through you, with your indulgence, that we actually run the presentation, because it also deals with the PPE corruption, it deals with other SOE matters outside of the directorate space, and also with the sign-off matter. And once we have the full picture, it might be more incisive for the members themselves, and it would perhaps facilitate the questions and answers. That would be my proposal, Chair.
Well, I think in terms of the question, the emphasis by Honourable Mende was on the question of impact. And indeed, the presentation that we have received currently indicates the sophistry around the web in dealing with some of the very complicated intricacies on matters of fraud and corruption. And in that instance, therefore, you take time. And in taking time, the assurance to take those matters for prosecution, when all is done, everything is the assurance and all the stuff has been. I think Advocate Kunye has emphasized the point of a newly acquired skill in terms of analysis on data, which it relates to all these kinds of elements, something which she says it has never existed, and now it is within the state apparatus to make use of such a kind of a skill. But there's another matter which we're going to look into, the Steynolf matter, which has been a matter that would rely on that capability. So I think the comment which has been made by Honorable Mende is on being urging to see some of these areas leading to some results. And that is what is out there, you know. So edginess is on that level. But we're going to allow this other presentation, which was going to be made by Major General Libia. Are you ready?
While General Libia gets ready, perhaps I can just answer the specific question on the Bedford View case.
No problem.
Thank you, Chair. That case was enrolled in December 2019. And the first issue, again, related to the volume of documents we disclosed to the defense. Now, there are a number of defendants, each with their own legal teams in that matter, and they have requested more time to consider the documents. But, Chair, I wanted to assure the member that impact is always uppermost in our minds, because we do move from the premise that around the world, these big corruption cases take a long time, and you have to come up with other more creative ways to register impact. And asset forfeiture certainly is one such way where you at least address the accused person's financial benefits. But what we've also done in this particular case is recognizing that because it's such a big case with so many accused persons, it will run for some time. We have brought separate tax evasion charges in respect of at least four of the accused persons in that matter. And so they are before court in those other matters as well. And because a tax evasion case is usually just very document intensive, there won't be lots of witnesses. It's often very, there are not many issues in dispute. We are hoping that those cases will resolve far more speedily. And then the other issue we are looking at in terms of speeding up these cases is the notion of a corruption court, a court dedicated to big corruption matters where we can have a continuous role so that these cases can have momentum and then run to finality without interruptions, because the minute you have a postponement, then it's a debate about how many lawyers you're going to try and get on one particular day. So I wanted to assure the Honourable Member that impact is at the top of our minds in trying to do things differently. But, there are many balls we are holding in trying to move us forward. But certainly the prosecutors and the ID know that a litigation strategy that ensures that the trial progresses speedily and that we are far more aggressive in moving cases forward and not postpone matters easily is something that's written on the walls all around us to make sure that we have that impact. So I just wanted to make that comment, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate Cronje. Can I give over to General Libia? Honorable Mende, we're still going to be reliant on the following report in terms of seeking to find a measure of satisfaction. In as far as outcomes are concerned. Can I allow General Libia?
Thank you very much, Chair.
My hand has been up. I'm not sure if you managed to see it. My name is...
There it is now. Okay, can we then allow Honorable Dolasha to raise a question?
No, good morning, Chair, colleagues, and the responsible officials in all these institutions. Chair, first and foremost, I want to welcome the report and appreciate it. Chair, indeed, we might sound like we are too anxious in wanting to get the outcome in whatever way. However, the advocates have been very consistent in taking us into confidence by explaining to us the route that needs to be followed for them to be able to come out with cases that really will be delivered accordingly. The problem we're having was sitting with the society that is looking forward to see people who are involved in corruption being punished. And as members of parliament, we have that kind of a pressure because we are the representatives of those people. But we cannot play your role. I really would want to appreciate the kind of work that you are doing. And I'm proud that you are both women. But also the newly acquired skill that you have managed to come up with, that we all rely to and congratulate. How I wish in the next report, you can speak more on these newly acquired skills that really assist us in making sure that we make sure that we deal with corruption in its totality. I'm waiting for other reports. Chair has indicated that more information is still to come. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you. The reliance, and I think you amplify the matter which has been raised by Honorable Mente on the results-driven approach in terms of these areas of criminality and the prosecutorial outcomes in as far as these instances are concerned. Well, the following report by General Libya would indeed, honorable members, be getting into that point. Can you allow General Libya? Thank you very much, honorable members.
Thank you very much, honorable chairperson and honorable members. I'm now going to deal with the presentation. Starting with the introduction, Honorable Chairperson, we have been requested as the SIU, NPA, and DPCI to provide progress report in respect of the matters of COVID-19 procurement PPEs, the corruption cases involving the state-owned entities, and also to provide update with regard to the status of the investigation in the State Hall matter. The presentation will also deal with the mandates of each of the institutions. Then we will proceed to the SOE as requested, and then I come to the COVID-related matters. The Steinhoff will come in a separate presentation. With regard to the presentation outline, it touches on the mandate, as I indicated, a brief outline of the methodology that we use in conducting our work, as well as the outline on the SOE matters, the COVID-19 matters that has been referred by the SIU to the NPA, and those matters that we are dealing with at the Fusion Center, as well as the summary of incident investigation from the Fusion Center. Then we will conclude with some challenges and solutions. Chairperson, I will not go in detail in respect of the mandate of the SIU, but safe to say that the primary legislation that guides their mandate is the Special Investigating Units and Special Tribunals Act of 1996, the Criminal Procedure Act of 1977, the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities of 2004. In the major function is to investigate corruption, malpractice,
and the maladministration and to ensure that civil proceedings are instituted. With regard to the powers that rest in the SIU, is to, once a proclamation has been issued, to be able to serve subpoenas, conduct search and seizure of evidence, and interrogate witnesses under oath. They also have to ensure that they institute civil litigation to recover state funds lost, or to ensure the prevention of future losses. The outcome of that mandate is to ensure that working with the colleagues in other environment, arrests and the prosecution are instituted. Implementation of disciplinary actions in those government departments that shall have been affected. And in doing this, they work closely with other relevant agencies and the organization. It is just the schematic indication of the consequences. Firstly, the litigation aspect, which I am already alluded to, is to ensure that they institute civil proceedings where there are potential recoveries of assets and apply preservation orders at an early stage where investigation shows that there is prima facie evidence. Disciplinary matters is where they refer to other state institutions, and the prosecution is to ensure that matters are referred to the NPA, which ensures investigation by the investigation agencies, including the SAPS and the DPCI in particular, and the referral to other regulatory authorities, including the South African Revenue Service. So the National Prosecuting Authority, with regard to its mandate, is firstly, it is established in terms of Section 179 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. The duties and the powers of prosecution authority are outlined in the Constitution as primarily institute and conduct criminal proceedings on behalf of the state, carry out any necessary functions incidental to institution and conducting of criminal proceedings, discontinue criminal proceedings where they were currently taking place. Thus, the NPA bears the vital responsibility of providing a coordinated prosecuting service that ensures justice is delivered to the victims of crime. Through general and specialized prosecution, they also remove the profit from crime and ensure the protection of witnesses. In continuation, within its specialized entities, the specialized commercial crime units within the NPA, as mandate is to guide criminal investigation and conduct the prosecution of complex commercial crime cases emanating from the commercial branches of the SAPS, including specifically,
Sorry, General. I'm sorry, Chair, to interrupt, but I'm just thinking that in the interest of time, Chair, but it's in your hands, that we can skip these mandate slides and go through to the, because the committee has the slides and it's just a matter of reading through it. It's just my proposal, Chair, in the interest of time.
Sustained.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair. General, you take note. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The next one was obviously at the specialized commercial crime unit capacity. Again, I think that the committee have got insight into what has been said here, but just safe to say that there is currently 154 prosecutorial posts that have been filled. And then the rest, I think the committee members will take a note of. The next one is the asset forfeiture unit capacity. This is an area that ensures that the proceeds crime are retrieved. And talking to the capacity, it remains a challenge in that area. I think that is where the prosecuting authority is working on filling all the senior management position to ensure that it is capacitated, because all the operational environment will rely on this when it comes to the assets. There is also a need for outside experts that have been consulted in dealing with complex matters. I'm not going to be reading sentence by sentence, as it is also part of the mandate, what has been done. With regard to the legal regime of this, the program creates two distinct mechanisms in respect of assets, but I will not deal in detail. It's just to ensure that we know is both Chapter 5 and Chapter 6, that is how they rely on dealing with the proceeds of crime. Others depend on the conviction, whereas other is civil in nature, but just know that it is two streams that they make use of in dealing with the assets. In the next slide is how the AFU is taking the profit out of crime, and it's a continuation of what they do in executing their mandate, is unpacking what their mandate is all about. And that they also make use of forensic audit reports, as well as the FIC generated reports in conducting their investigation. As I pointed out, they work in collaboration with the investigators from the SAPS, the DPCI, and the Investigative Directorate. So that is where they deal with all of the assets that have been identified by these entities. With regard to the DPCI mandate, I will again not be reading that. Safe to say that it is we focus on serious organized crime, serious commercial crime, as well as serious corruption. The rest of the areas I will not touch on. The working methodology between the SIU and the NPA and the DPCI is there are obviously arrangements. The SIU is working in terms of the act that established it. And then when they have identified the criminal matters, they refer those to the NPA. And at the same time, they share with the DPCI so that we are not behind. But then the NPA will ensure that an investigation is being conducted, some of these which are done in the regional offices. And thereafter, a prosecution-guided investigation will take place, and the DPCI will prepare the docket. Once the docket is completed, the prosecution will take decision on the prosecution or otherwise. With regards to the summary of the matters that are related to ESCOM, just to say that there are 39 matters, even though we will not be unpacking and dealing with each of these, but just take note that there are 39 matters that are handled relating to ESCOM. Three of these have been transferred to Investigative Directorate in the NPA. And then under investigation are 17, 12 of these matters are already in court. And there is one conviction and sentence that has been finalized. And then in six of the matters, the NPA have, with based on the evidence presented, declined to prosecute. And then coming to this other slide, here is just to unpack some of these matters that I'm referring to. I will not be reading in detail. Safe to say that with regard to the ESCOM matter, looking at the first one, there is ESCOM in Orlando. That is where senior managers of ESCOM secretly and unlawfully created fraudulent documentation in order to buy and sell ESCOM properties without the knowledge of ESCOM. As it can be seen, the status of this matter is on the far right-hand side. That is, a decision has been taken to prosecute on this matter, and the summons have been sent issued. in the second one again is where we are dealing with copper cables. Without reading the content of the brief summary of what has happened there in Upington, we can see that again a decision has been taken to prosecute on this matter, and the summonses have been issued. It just shows the progress. And then the third one is again a matter that is at a court where the state versus Tabalala and another is serving. The court date, as it can be seen on the far right-hand side, is will be taking place in March. The activities that they were busy doing can be seen on the left, but here an amount of 13 million rand was paid by Eskom to the entity that the individual pretended that it deserved to receive. Number four is an Eskom matter. Again, here is the matter of Mutimunye and another. Here we are dealing with a matter that involved 42 counts of fraud. So the matter is at a court. Again, it's just to show progress that it is progressing. Moving to the fifth one, here is the again, the matter of the state versus Murubane that involves Eskom, Murubane and others. Here we are dealing with 16 counts of fraud as well as 45 counts of money laundering. Again, this matter is in court and then it's saving before the court. The sixth matter is that of the state versus Makeke. Makeka and another. Again, in this one, the case is remanded in April. It is saving before court. There are obviously specific transactions that have been done, as it can be seen, 80 purchase orders totaling an amount of 1.8 million rand, which were later paid to an entity. The figure might not have been, it should be 18 million. And then the matter is coming on the 14th of April in court. In number seven is the state versus Tabalala and another. And then in this one is 3 million. There are 44 counts of fraud. The matter is once more saving in court and then it's postponed to assess. The AFU is also assessing the content of the report. In all the reports, the asset forfeiture unit will be reflected as to what are the activities that they are busy doing. In number eight is again the state versus the Makeka. And then the matter is once more postponed to in court. This one is saving in Johannesburg court. Matter number nine that have occurred in Hartsfontein. The matter is once more in court, and then the case is postponed. The two charges of fraud and theft are being dealt with in this matter. In the Kempton Park, there is also a link of the same matter that involved the Hartsfontein, but again, the matter is postponed, is saving before court. The process, the AFU will deal with the asset once prosecution has been finalized. In matter number 11, that happened in the Hartsfontein, it's still in Hartsfontein, it is still linked to the matter that we have talked to that have occurred in Hartsfontein. So they will be, they are being prosecuted in respect of the various areas where the crime was committed. In Viederbrech, Luarte, the accused was found in possession of an Eskom credit dispensing unit, and then the matter is again postponed in court. So these are similar matters that are featured in court. Going further to the finalized matter of ESCOM that I have indicated, I will not be reading on this, but safe to say that it is a matter that involved an amount of 800,000 when it comes to fining accused number one on the first count. Accused number two was given 15 years imprisonment, and the third accused, in respect of count two, the first accused was given 10 million rand in fine, and then the accused number two was given 15 years imprisonment in respect of I think that there is an editing error. We can just take that I was fined to 15 years imprisonment. I think that they normally also add incapacity, that you are also not going to be possessing a firearm. So that becomes a declaration. Coming to the Transnet matters, there are two matters that deal specifically with the Transnet. Both matters are still under investigation. We haven't dealt with the unpacking of the details. Coming to the PRASA, there are 19 matters that are also under investigation. All these PRASA matters are under investigation. The three cases are emerging from the 2015. Other 16 case dockets were opened in 2019. So all these matters are under investigation. And then while in others we are waiting for the forensic audit reports, in other matters it is the report that are still expected from the Financial Intelligence Center. So there are obvious DS. The matters, most of them, as reported in 2019, still need to be attended to. Resources is one of those challenges that will affect the speedy finalization of these matters. There are also some persons in some of the departments sometimes who have difficulty in assisting in speedy provisioning of the documents that audited of some of the matters. In some of the matters, it's the I think the acquisition of the forensic capacity, which at times we rely on external role players, but on this one, there is a work that is taking place where we are looking at how this can be speeded up. There are also some forensic reports that are contributing not much with regards to what is in prosecution, which shall also have been raised by the ID in one of the matters that they have presented, that they also had to revisit the report that was already available. Some are just the challenges of administrative in nature that exist between the forensic auditors that are compiling reports that at times they are not being directed by entities that obtain their services, that they will be obliged to come and testify in the criminal trials that will come out of the report that they have submitted. The lengthy process of procurement has also been highlighted by the ID in a part of its presentation. Some of the SOE is related to the South African Airways. There is a matter that is under investigation where witnesses are still testifying in the state capture commission. We will not detail those, but it has been noted that there is already some of the evidence placed in the criminal docket. With regards to denial matter, there is a one matter. Obviously, under this investigation, there are several case dockets that are being referred to that are also being investigated. Investigation is also ongoing in regards to this matter. The next category is those of the COVID-19 matters that are handled at the fusion center. In regards to the COVID-19 corruption-related incidents and the cases that are investigated, as well as the recoveries of the proceeds from crime by law enforcement agencies that are coordinated at the fusion center, there is a total number of 142 registered incidents, of which 119 are still under investigation, where SA 23 have been closed. There is also a total of 126 case dockets that have been registered, of which 101 are still under investigation, and then 9 have been closed, whereas 17 are serving before court that involve 34 accused persons. This report is as on the 10th of March 2021. We should always look at the date on which we are saying this, because the information is updated on a regular basis. In this regard, at the table at the bottom, it will show it's just a summary of those matters. The 119, one can see those that have been closed. But the area that I did not touch on is the one at the extreme, right, with regards to the asset. That is the FIC. As it can be seen here, there are accounts that have been freezed to the value of 146 million. And then in the AFU is 119 million. And then the SIU, 289 million. And the SARS, 215 million. So those are matters that are coordinated at the fusion center. Let me also indicate that the SIU is also making referrals on this COVID-19. So there are 59 matters that have been received from the SIU, and of which 13 relate to various incidents and projects with multiple accused and the suspect. All these matters are referred to the divisions in the DPP, and then of which the DPCI is playing a role in the registration and the investigation thereof. So the matters were referred to were received in September last year. Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, this slide now deals with the details of those matters that we say that they are at court. And I think it will not be necessary to read each of these matters that are on the court roll, as the Honorable Members will have received the presentation, but the details of each of these cases that are serving before court, all the 17 of them have been listed in these three slides. Honorable Chairperson, the date on which the next hearing will be coming indicated on the extreme right-hand side. The amount that has involved is in the penultimate end to, of the columns. And then I will not read the details of this one, but safe to say that all the details are reflected in the slide. With regards to the referrals by the SIU, again, without not reading the nitty-gritties of the details, it can be seen that there were two matters that were referred to from the Department of Health, which also indicate at the far hand right side as to the amount that is involved and then the criminal case that emanate out of that. So that is a part of those matters which I have had in the Eastern Cape that talks to the ambulance, scooters, those matters as well as the related activities. In OR Tambo, there are three matters that they have been referred to, and one can already see that there are criminal matters that also refer to this famously known as the door-to-door canvassing campaign with regards to this COVID-19 related matters. We can also see the state of the treasury, the provincial treasury, having referred six matters, and then the progress of this one is also indicated. The cases have been reported on this, as it can be seen that it's in November, where criminal case was opened, as well as in 2021. Three entities with those inquiries that have been reported. In Gauteng, there are also referral of two matters that has to do with the senior level of management, official on a senior level. And then the prosecutor has also been assigned to guide the investigator. So those matters are being investigated as the criminal case docket is reflected in the middle of the slide where we talk of case number for the DPCR. So those matters are still under investigation. And then coming to the next slide, from KwaZulu-Natal, there are one matter referred from the social development. A case docket was opened in July last year. And then from the Department of Education, nine matters were referred to from KwaZulu-Natal, and the cases were reported in November. So these matters are under investigation. And then again in KwaZulu-Natal, the Department of Social Development in July, the responsible persons that are affected on these are also on senior management. There is also nine matters from the Department of Education. In this one, the case was reported in November in Durban Central. It's also under investigation. And then in the Spukuni district municipality, there are two referrals, and a case is open in July last year and is still under investigation by the DPCR. The National DPW, there is seven matters that have been referred to that are under investigation. The NPS appointed prosecutor who's assisting, and then the DPCI is in the process of ensuring the registration of the case docket on this matter. There are also other matters in the Razo municipality in the Northwest, JP Mast, and the Department of Environmental and the Forestry and Fisheries. That's sorry for that, Honorable Chairperson. There are also some risks and challenges that are affecting some of the developments. Some of those are being addressed investigation teams when it comes to the capacity, is that area that the IDS also hinted on the resources that in prioritization you always take from another area. That is why some of the cases are not moving as speedily as we would like to be seeing. The workload that some of the officials are carrying make it difficult to move speedily. We are aware that some of the matters that are saving before the fusion center, which are also relating to the UIF, which are in the majority, more than 80 to be specific, are the ones that are at this stage not moving as speedily as we would like to, but the relevant authorities are working on that. There is also a delay in some of the areas where the capacity of some of the departments are overstretched, and this at times poses some challenges also at the provincial level. But we have engaged at the ACTT level to try to improve on those challenges. Also in the supply chain, official at times have got difficulty in ensuring that relevant information that is required is provided to investigating officers. This, as a result, causes some of the delays, which at times you even find that we serve some notices to confirm the provision of those documents. The COVID-19 have also played its role as the isolation and the quarantine and the decontamination of offices and the working in rotation fashion have also contributed to the delays. And I think the 2020 was actually affected. Much of the days in the 2020 were affected by this, as also the minimum number of attendance in court was also affected. There are also the areas of the bank statements that at times they were delayed, which phone calls were utilized in an attempt to try to improve on that. But the availability of staff has always contributed in this area, that when the staff were not available, the provision at times gets affected. Reliance on external forensic auditors and companies also poses some challenges. And I think that the entities within the government is trying its utmost best to appoint officials that can be assisting in this. I think in one area, the DPCI will be closing the advert that has been made on the 19th of this month with regards to the chartered accountants, so that we don't rely solely on external role players. And the JCPS, under the leadership of the National Director of Public Prosecution, have got a project that looks at the consideration of capacity of the forensic audit in the government. That is chaired by the FIC, but within the bigger project of reviewing the JCPS activities. Due to different concealment methods, the procedure of crime at times is complicated to recover that. As I indicated during the presentation of the challenges, there are mitigating circumstances, mitigating actions that are put in place. The SAPS is resourcing its operators in the detective service. The matter is receiving attention also within the DPCI to address those shortages. We have got several projects. Among them, we are getting 103 personnel at the beginning of next month. And we have got other projects, the advertisement of 297 personnel that will be coming out this Sunday to ensure that we try to attract skilled personnel that can be trained to assist in capacitating. There are other projects that are also attempting to assist in getting the resources to capacitate us. A decision has been taken by the ACTT principal at the executive committee to roll out the method, the fusion center model that is being utilized at national level to ensure that that operational method is actually taking place in the provinces without establishing a fusion center itself, but the operational model. And I think here we have got the competent officials that are guiding that process in the life of the Deputy National Director of Public Prosecution, Advocate Dikop, that is working with the DPCI Advocate, Musipi, in this regard. The National Treasury is also working on assisting when it comes to supply chain risks. The department also work, and then in some areas there are the laws that I have indicated in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act that are being utilized. A number of cases have been identified to form joint prioritization. Within these priority matters, there are 10 high priority cases that are worked in by the DPCI, the NPA, and the other stakeholders, as indicated, the SIU and the FIC. This is to ensure that cases are being fast-tracked. Among them, it includes the Steinhoff matter that I will also be talking to. I have already indicated reliance on external forensic auditors that we are working on the process of improving that particular arrangement. And then I have also indicated that the ACTT principals have established training committee that is also geared towards training those that will be recruiting into this environment, including the shortage of forensic and financial investigators in the government as a whole. As I've indicated, a project is there run at the JPPS level. The ACTT Case Management Committee was reconstituted. As we shall have noted that in the past, we were not as effective as we were supposed to be, but we are resuscitating some of those areas where we think we can be able to enhance the way we are dealing with corruption matters. And as I have indicated, there are committees and operational officials that are guiding this operation at various levels. We have got a case priority committee. And then the ACTT Executive Committee has decided that much closer cooperation is required with the different participants. And in this regard, we are addressing that on a regular basis in our structures, in our meetings. We share on those areas for commitment from our stakeholders. We have, as I indicated, commissioned a task team to research and investigate feasibility of creating a forensic capability in the state that is spearheaded by FIC, as I have indicated, the JTPS project headed by the NDPP. The work at is at an advanced stage. And the details of the presentation was done to the executive committee, but this, when it becomes mature, it will be presented. I think the presentation to one of the committees yesterday they have also indicated that they would like to have this proposal. Whistleblowers are still hesitant to come forward. However, discussions with the stakeholders in the DPSA are continuing to ensure that where the legislation has got some gaps, it can be enhanced to close those gaps to ensure protection of witnesses. Several witnesses are currently in the witness protection program, and the NPA will continue to protect the witnesses and their families where there is potential harm and intimidation. Chairperson and honorable members conclude the presentation on the joint submission, but then we will be moving over to the last one, that is the Stain Hawk.
Okay.
Just that the system seems to be just giving a small challenge here, Chairperson. But we want to be moving to the Stain Hawk matter.
Chairman, are you there? Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Is the head of the Hawk done?
No, not yet done.
I heard him saying there's a technicality.
Yes, we want to yes, we wanted to stop that so that we load the style of matter.
All right. Let's take the style of matter. Let's take all of it together. I'm seeing our time is not... so let's take all of it together.
The system from our side is moving very slow. If the secretariat is able to load...
Okay, let them assist you with that because we want that stand of matter now and complete it and we're good to go. Yeah. That's a...
Can the secretary of the committee help us load the slide to share? Our system is moving very slow here.
Okay, let's do that.
Thanks.
That's
visible now. It's up. Let's get moving with that. Yeah.
Okay.
General.
I think we are not able to see the.
General, the presentation is up.
Chairperson, I'm going to then read on my handset, and then I'll ask the secretariat just to say that I'm now in the slide number two. Can we move over to slide number two?
Okay, that's fine.
This one is just an indication of the cases, starting at the extreme left-hand side, is the cases that we are dealing with. As it can be seen, it's the Stellenbosch cases of 2017, the Sunset case 2018, the inquiry of
2018 as well as the Bantan case of 2020. The offences that we are investigating include the fraud contravention of the Prevention of Corrupt Activities Act, the contravention of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, the contravention of the Companies Act, as well as the contravention of the Financial Market Act. The individuals that are linked to the investigation, we haven't mentioned their names as it is a practice that we don't mention them, but they are part of the officials that were in the Isle of management. The prejudice that we have so far is 6.5 billion euros. And then we have obtained a number of statements in the investigation, as it can be seen. 220 statements were filed in this matter. Coming to slide number three, that talks to the background. Steinhoff is a company registered in the Netherlands. I will not read paragraph by paragraph, Honorable Chairperson, as I think that the committee have got the report and the shall I have read through. But safe to say that the dockets, certain dockets, were also reported by Steinhoff in terms of Section 34 of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities, making Steinhoff to become a complainant in part of this investigation. And then other cases were investigated, were registered by other interested parties. And it shall be seen at the end of the last bullet there, we say that Steinhoff reported the matter to the DPCI in terms of Section 34 of BRCA, and also appointed PwC to establish the extent of the financial irregularities. That I think is also will also be part of what the committee might be interested in. The next slide, slide number four, is talking to the audit report by the PwC. The previous presentations that were done at in the committee, there was those indications that we expected the PwC to share the report with us, and after sharing the report with the investigators and the prosecutors, they went through those reports, and then they found that there is still a need to conduct further investigation. So the PwC report in its current format was found to be only dealing primarily with the accounting irregularities, and a need to focus on criminality, the matters that will be able to go to criminal court. So as a result of that, Chairperson, on the 1st of April 2020, PwC forensic accountants were appointed by the DPCI with a detailed mandate to investigate and prepare a report with a focus on criminality and criminal processes. We need to say that this process that have led to this decision was motivated extensively by the team that were working on this, including the Deputy Director of Public Prosecution that is seized with this, and the senior advocates that are involved in this matter. So after consideration of various aspects, it was decided that instead of wanting to go and start de novo, we should appoint at no cost to the state, the PwC, to conduct the forensic investigation and finalize. So at this stage, we can safely say that we were expecting that it should have been finalized by the end of November last year,
But with regard to COVID, the entity indicated that they are able to finalize that on the 31st of March, which is the end of this month. That is what we are expecting that they will be doing. Honorable Chairperson and members, in slide number five, we just summarize, indicate that the number of statements that have been filed, and then I said these are affidavits from witnesses, statements in terms of section 205, 236, 212 of the Criminal Procedure Act, and the monthly case plan are still continuing between the prosecution team and the investigators, and the meeting with multidisciplinary partners are continuing. And at the time of preparing this, we were saying 70% of the audit is completed, but I have indicated that by the end of this month, we have been assured that it will be complete. The asset for future units of the NPA is on board. And then in slide number six, we just indicate that a total of six other statements has been filed in the new docket that was not part. This honorable chairperson, we can see that it was only registered in November last year, based on some of the aspects that were identified by the team that is doing the audit. Based on this one is generally insider trading that was picked up, but already a monthly plan are done, and then the meeting is also taking place, and the asset for future unit is involved. Slide number seven unpacks the case of Sunset, the main docket. In that one, one can just indicate the 23 statements that were filed there, as well as other matters that are involved. There are other counties that are involved, and then 33 foreign bank accounts that have also been identified. And then coming to slide number eight, is just the indication of once we get those four statements, the matter will also be completed. The final slide just only point out the multidisciplinary partners that we engage in conducting this investigation. Honorable Chairperson and honorable members, that conclude the Steinhoff matter and also conclude the presentation. My colleagues from the NPA may also want to be added, as well as the other partners that are forming part of the investigation and the prosecution. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I submit.
Yes. Thank you very much, General. Can we get questions, honourable members?
Oh, I wanted to deal proactively. Deal with this. Chair, with respect, Chair, if I may, just before questions, the NDPP, on one aspect of regarding to the payment of the money in respect of the forensic audit in the Steinhoff matter, if I may deal with it very quickly, or would you prefer to go?
Let's not deal with it, and then.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, this
get the full
matter,
picture, and then honourable.
Thank you, Chair. This matter received a lot of publicity, the fact that the PwC that was actually mandated by Steinhoff to conduct the forensic investigation. I just want to clarify, Chair, firstly, it was, well, the NPA did not receive any funding from Steinhoff or from Steinhoff. And then, Chair, to really explain that the practice of forensic accounting firms being commissioned by companies to deal with these kinds of forensic analysis and forensic exercises is not unusual. And in this particular case, you know, the PwC was involved for a long term in terms of finalizing a report on the mandate of Steinhoff. But subsequent to that, because of that report was not, what's the word? It was not, the mandate wasn't to look for criminality. And so it was essentially an accounting driven report, so to speak. And so because of the work that had gone into it, and because Steinhoff was essentially, you know, the entire board and all of those implicated persons were removed from the Steinhoff structures, including executive board positions. Steinhoff, as the general had said, had also made complaints, criminal complaints regarding certain matters. There was no possibility that they would want to, so to speak, negatively influence the forensic investigation process. So this was discussed by the prosecutors, and there were various safeguards that were put in place, including PwC has signed a certificate in terms of Section 4 of the Protection of Information Act, and so it provides against any disclosures of confidential information during this forensic investigation. In addition to that, you know, the findings will be supported by independent objective evidence, as you know, such as bank statements, journals, ledgers, databases, emails, memos, etc. And they have also agreed that taking into consideration the consequences of Section 4 of the Information Act, no evidence obtained during this criminal investigation that they are conducting will be divulged even to Steinhoff for the purposes of any civil litigation. So this is not unusual, and it has been thoroughly thought through by the prosecutors and investigators. So I thought it's important that I just mention that, given that this matter has received a lot of publicity recently. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you, NDPP. We will come to that matter, noting what you have said. Can we get on the list, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning to everyone. Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to just start at the back because that's the end, because that's really fresh in our minds now, the Steinhoff matter. Mr. Chairman, I think we've said for a long time the importance of this particular matter being seen through to a conclusion where everyone involved is held accountable. And General Levere would remember my irritation with him and his people approximately a year or so ago when he reported that only one transaction after a year had been investigated. And so it is very encouraging to see the what appears to be considerable progress made since then. However, Mr. Chairman, there is not a word there about whom I, and I think most South Africans who are aware of this, believe to be the main protagonist here. Mr. Visa had some very descriptive words to describe Marcus Yuster. And yet I see nothing here. So my question is, where are we with a prosecution of Mr. Yuster? Have assets been seized? What is the situation with what many of us perceive to be the mastermind behind this massive corporate fraud? Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure whether we're going to do this on a hearing basis or whether I should proceed with all my other questions. What would you like me to do, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, would you like me to do it question by question on a hearing basis, which I enjoy doing it that way, but it's your priority.
I'm looking at time, and this was a briefing which has become a bit
protracted. So can you pose all your questions and then you will come in if they are not responded to for follow-ups rather.
Okay. Great. So, no problem at all, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. So that's the first question on Steinhoff. The next question on Steinhoff, General, you list all the sort of co-partners in this from the South African Reserve Bank, et cetera, but I noticed that the South African Revenue Services aren't there, and I would think that they might actually be playing a role, and I was wondering why they weren't included. With regard to the PwC report, those of us who have been involved in this case from its inception will recall the new board, not the old board, the new board's considerable reluctance to release the PwC report. And in the end, it was a decision by the parliamentary committees and I'm not sure that we really had the authority, but we said the report will be released. And so I say that because whilst I'm comforted by the words that there's certain safeguards with regard to the forensic investigation, I do hope that we don't face the kind of resistance that we faced with the initial PwC report. Then, Mr. Chairman, I just want to move on to the PPE issues. The ambulance scooter, as it's referred to on slide 34 of your presentation, General, or joint presentation, it refers briefly to this particular matter. What I'm interested in there is who exactly is being charged and what with? And may I perhaps bring Advocate Matibi in the sense that my question from an SIU point of view would be, was there any conflict of interest that existed between the SIU investigator, Glenn Muller, and the manufacturers of the ambulance scooter, or individuals there? There seems that there may have been an issue there, but I would like some details of that. And of course, my initial point being, who exactly is being prosecuted in this matter, and what for? Does it include the manufacturer? Then, I'm not sure whether or not this has got to your desk, General Labeer, but there's the SIU, and again, Advocate Matibi might have to answer this. The SIU were conducting an investigation into the Moyamgeni municipality's use of MIG funding for PPE purposes. And misuse of that funding. One of the issues that seemed to be a major problem was the officials of the municipality and senior councillors perhaps having informed National Treasury that the council made a resolution to request permission from National Treasury to use the MIG funding for PPE purposes. Apparently, the accusation is there was never such a council resolution passed by the council, and that the request to National Treasury in that sense was at best a misrepresentation, at worst simply fraud. So whether that case is moving forward, it might need a response from Advocate Matibi or from you, General Labeer. But, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. May I leave it at that for now?
All right. Thank you, Honourable Miss. Let's get responses to that set of questions so that we can move. And then if there's any follow-up you want to make, you can come in at that point.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I hope that I'm audible.
Yes, you are.
Thank you, Chairperson. With regards to the question of the cooperation, the partners that have been mentioned there, I think that the others, they have not written them as a permanent. I accept that SARS should have been part of those that they are collaborating on a permanent basis like others. So it has not been included. I think we shall consider that one, the inclusion. With regard to the question of the reluctancy or otherwise of the report by PwC that it should not be happening like it has in the past. This time around, I think that the agreement that we have signed as an advocate, Batoi, as indicated, that report is intended for law enforcement only. And then it will only be provided for the purpose of criminal prosecution. So we will not experience those challenges. It has been agreed on that one. That will also serve until the matter is served in a court of law. The challenges that may come will be dealt with at court. With regards to the individuals that are being charged on the Steinhoff and the like, generally, Honorable Chairperson, the practices that we are, from our investigation point of view, while we are investigating, we do not name the individuals, but I think that my colleagues can talk to the issue of assets and others. But otherwise, the names of those that the investigation is directed to, we will name them once they are being charged. We are hopeful that there will be individuals that are to be charged. On the issue of the PPE, the slide 34, I think that the SIU might be able to talk to that one, but from the investigation point of view, this slide starting from 34 are those that the matter have not yet appeared in court. So it is only the slide before that one we're talking about matters that are at court. Those that are under investigation, that practice of not naming them apply. We will indicate at the right moment as to who should actually be accounting for this one, Honorable Chairperson or Honorable Members. My colleagues may also come in to assist where I may have left.
Chair, if we may just quickly on the asset forfeiture part of it, I'm going to ask Advocate Peter Bezadenholt, who is the, I'm not sure if you can see him, but he's the acting head of the asset forfeiture unit in Victoria that's dealing with this, and he will just deal with that part of it.
May it please you, Mr. Chair, and other members of the committee. In respect of asset forfeiture procedures in Steinhoff, we are working closely with the DPCI. We are assisting the DPCI where we can in the investigation. We are awaiting the final PwC report that's coming out short in the span of this year. And
then
end of this month, I am informed. And then one issue that needs to be taken into account, please, is that we still have a certain standard to consider before we can move on any asset forfeiture proceedings. That is that reasonable grounds to believe must be present, that there was any unlawful activity, and that unlawful activity can either be tied to either criminal forfeiture, us moving in criminal forfeiture proceedings, or in civil forfeiture proceedings. Apart from that, that will be my submission.
Yes, thank you. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that. So, Chair, it's the report will be quite important. The PwC report will be quite important in terms of asset forfeiture moving in this case, Chair. Thank you.
All right, Honourable Lee, are you fine?
No, Mr. Chairman, I am. Yeah, look, I mean, in terms of what's been responded to, it's really very disappointing given the incredibly long period of time that's elapsed with regard to sign off. And, you know, the PwC, the next PwC report is due at the end of this month, so we're told. So I hope we hear very soon about charges being laid and assets being forfeited. But that aside, I haven't had a response regarding the ambulance scooters and the conflict of interest there, nor to the Moyamgeni MIG fund use.
All right, let's get just a follow-up, and then Honourable Somi will come in.
I think that's for the SIU, Chair. I'm not sure Advocate Machibi is on this platform.
Thank you. Thank you, NGPP. I'd like to just respond to the one question raised by Honourable Lees around the scooter matter. This matter, as it's now... Hello? Okay, thank you. As it's now... Okay, SIU investigated this matter and we found irregularities, and that's why we are at court now, and some of the matters reported into the criminal justice system. So now, the point raised by Honourable Lee around the possible conflict, let me just say that as we speak today, there has been no formal report sent to SIU about any conflict of interest between our investigator and the company that was involved in this matter, except to say that there was a newspaper inquiry by a journalist who inquired along these lines that were there any conflict of interest, did the investigator and the owner of the company relate socially in instances that date back to more than 20 years ago. And then we obviously had to look into that as we responded to the journalist. And our investigator was quite emphatic that the matters that the journalist referred to, he has never ever, engaged or discussed with the owner of the company involved, and therefore there would have been no conflict of interest, at least even to that level. So, Honourable Lees, I am satisfied as we speak today that there was no conflict of interest at the time when the investigation commenced. And even at the time when it was raised by the newspapers, we looked into it. We couldn't find any substantive evidence that there was any conflict of interest. So that's where this matter is. As I indicated, that subsequent to that, there has never been any formal reporting to us in terms of this matter. With regards to, I just didn't hear the name of the council, the one that used the MIG funding. If you can just please, Honourable Liz, just favour me with the... I have Umgeni here, but I want to make sure that I recorded it properly. However, if be that as it may, I had not prepared any detailed response on this, if it is Umgeni or any other municipality. So I'm going to ask the Honourable Member Liz and the committee indulgence that we look into this matter and respond to the committee in writing. I've got the question as there was a allegation that the council used MIG funding for PPE funding, and that the council made a request to Treasury to use the MIG funding, and that in fact the allegation goes that that request was a misrepresentation. So we would probably have looked into this, but Honourable Liz, just the exact name of the council, please.
It's Moya Mgeni. It's part of the Mgungundlovu district.
Mgungundlovu. Okay.
Its main town is Hike.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for that. But I do not have the exact details now. I really plead that we be given indulgence to come back to the committee in writing. You can give us a number of days, and then we will submit on this one. Thank you.
That's absolutely no problem with me, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you
very much. Right, Honourable Samuel.
Well, thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I could see your interest now, where your interest is. Very fascinating. Nevertheless, Chair, I think the report by General Sibeya is somewhat assisting in a number of areas. But there's one area which I would want to just to ascertain on, the area which relates to the witness protection program. How firm is that program? And because if you follow the actual committal of some of these kinds of transgressions, they involve quite a lot of a number of those witnesses which would have to receive firm protection. In as far as the witnesses are concerned. The second area relates to what Honorable Liz has spoken to, the stain of the matter. I'm not sure whether you have cited the CIPC, because one of the hindrances that you highlighted earlier on when we dealt with this matter about a year or two ago, was in relation of some confirmations which ought to be made to CIPC in as far as some companies are concerned, because of the chain of such companies which are involved, both domestic and international and so forth. The third area relates to the report, PwC report, which initially Steinhoff insisted to hold on what was termed then professional privilege, which would protect the usage of that report and reliance on that report by the investigating structures in terms of law enforcement agencies. And they, through that reliance, they only permitted the Hawks and the NPA just to see the report at the time and to read the report, but not to take it or own it. Whether is there, therefore, a link between what is coming up as a new approach in terms of the appointment of the same PwC to conduct another forensic investigation reliant on criminal specific matters, whether there would be no leaning on the earlier report, which was sort of a protected in terms of our privilege. The fourth matter relates to the question that relates to just a confirmation from my part of attending to those matters. I think looking into the minute of the 19th of March 2019, your team indicated that there are some investigations which are directed at the following individuals. One is Marcus Juste, the second is Dirk Schreiber, Ben LaGrange, and Stefan Krobler, Sigmar Smith, Alan Evans, Jean Noel Pasquale, and David Ramona. Whether it still remains the same, that the focus of your investigation still is on, as per that minute of the March 2019, 19th March 2019, when you appeared in Parliament, that still hold as the focal point for your investigations. And lastly, would be the sense that there's this highly publicized matter. I think the NDPP has spoken to it in relation to the 30 million rand which has been received from Steno. If indeed, when I heard from the head of communication, there was reference on the matter having gone into the investigations as part of the PwC extensive investigations. Whether is that the case? Whether it looks like the NDPP is saying no money was received from Steno. And lastly, is that initially it looked like there was reluctance, though one individual was prepared to write a statement on behalf of the company for charges to be laid. Whether Steinhoff ultimately did present a statement for the matters for charges to be preferred. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair.
Right. Thanks, Honourable Samuel. Can we get a response to those questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. And then I think that the first one with regards to the witness protection program, the NPA will deal with that one. And then on the question of the CIPC, we will also include it as we are working in most of the matters. We are working with it. It has not been included as it is not permanently, but we will include it as the contribution is the same as others. The PwC report, whether it links with the previous one and whether we will have similar challenge of privileges and the like, in agreeing to be utilizing the services of the PwC, it was understood that the information where there was reluctance was administrative in nature. So those were the violation of internal processes, the way in which the company ran its business. But all criminal matters that have already been identified at the time of doing that internal work will find its way into the one that the PwC have now been officially assigned to do for the purpose of a criminal investigation, which means that they will sift the relevant information from the original report that is talking to other aspects that are not relevant to a crime and only deal with those matters that relate to crime. And then a new report will then be produced. So the old report, we will not be utilizing that one. With regard to the issue of the names, may I plead that we do not mention the names elsewhere. When it slips our mind, we mention the name of the people that are still under investigation, not yet charged. We may have slipped in the tongue, but if we can be spared on that one. But whoever have got anything to answer, whoever we may have detected that has done anything wrong, that will be a matter that will be considered by the NPA. We will not be excluding anyone or do anything. It's just that I need not to be dealing with the names, Honorable Chairperson, if I can be pardoned on that one. On the question of the 30 million rand that was talked to in the media, from the DPCI, as the NPA has explained, from the DPCI we have said that this work that the PwC is going to do is going to be at no cost to the state. So as the companies that assign internal auditors or whoever to do the investigation from time to time provide the resources that they shall have done. But we are not receiving any 30 million from from the Steinhoff in order to pay PwC. So that 30 million is the interpretation, the way in which the media statement has been phrased is incorrect. So we are getting these services at no cost to the state. The statements that were some officials were reluctant to provide. At this stage, we are happy that we have received all the statements that were needed for the purpose of proceeding with the investigation. Those that have come forward, we received the statement. If there is a necessity after the PwC report of getting additional statements, we shall still be doing so, Honorable Chairperson. I think the other questions, my colleagues will be able to deal with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. If I may, on the issue of the witness protection program, I may have missed exactly what the question was, but the witness protection program is being managed from the National Prosecuting Authority at the moment. It's a robust program. But I should say already that, we expect that there's going to be a lot more pressure on the witness protection program as we move forward on a number of these cases. And the issue of, and I know we're in very constrained times, but if we cannot provide really good witness protection services, we can forget about trying to prosecute many of these cases, which are going to put not just witnesses, but all, various, whether it's investigators, prosecutors, different categories of people at considerable risk. But dealing specifically with witness protection, there will need to be, certainly more finances put into. For now, it's fine, but I think we're on the edge. So I think that's going to be an important issue moving forward. And just on the Steinhoff matter again, I want to emphasize General Abiyaz, mentioned that, it's at no cost to the state, and that is correct. But I think that might, in fact, be one of the concerns, that you have a company that you're meant to be investigating that is actually paying for the forensic services. And that's why I want to make very clear that given the safeguards, given the fact that all of the previous board, including the executive, are no longer there, the company is, in fact, cooperating very much, is regarded as a complainant in many of the cases that have been opened up. We don't see any risk that there will be an attempt by the company to, in fact, prevent persons from being held accountable. So I think it's very important to bear that in mind. And I agree with General Labia, we really shouldn't mention the names of any persons until they appear in court. Thank you very much, Chair.
Chairman, by the way, I think thank you very much, General Labia, for the answers provided. I think on the state of matter, it has become a matter for national interest, since it has taken even an international turn in terms of the events. So it will be one of the encouraging matters that we tightened up and begin to act on it. Okay. I thank you very much for the answers provided there.
Thanks also, Mr. Yeah, so much. Just on that matter quickly before we move on from it. I think we're going to need a far more comprehensive briefing on the sign off matters. And probably develop a reporting mechanism along the lines of a monthly report, even if in writing. I think the matter has been too protracted, has not come to any sort of convincing direction or any conclusion for that matter. And we are pained because it seems as if there's a business as usual approach, whereas a lot of things went wrong. And so I think the probing that Honorable Lees was doing, and yourself, Honorable Somio, is the kind of approach we need to take on this matter, so that it can actually lead us in a direction wherein these matters will be concluded. But the Steinhoff matter just can't be lingering on, because it goes on to the issue of the funding. Because some of these things, it's from a perception point of view. No matter how noble the intentions may be, and no matter how nuanced the explanation can be, but from a perception point of view on its own, it just doesn't augur well. And it is quite worrisome. So I think we need to look at it holistically from the reporting point of view and the financial implications of this, because then if the NPA it has got shortfalls in so far as funding is concerned, then we need to look at the state machinery's ability to fund some of these urgent matters which have had extensive damage and corruption that has taken place, because Steinhoff was corruption. It's not should never be nuanced in any other way. And so all these things combined require a far more concerted outlook of oversight and reporting, and we may not do justice to today. I just wanted to underscore that issue, colleagues, because we must not be seen to be selective in so far as how the oversight is done. Right. So, Honourable Mente can come in then.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, Chair, I agree with you fully that we need a much more extensive program to deal with the issues of Stanov. Because looking at the volume of documents we've been presented with, I think I had set Scopa with Scopa Finance and not sure, I think Trade and Industry in some occasions, I think about three occasions where we had meetings together between NPA and other law enforcement, there were issues. Now, with the questions I have, it means that we need to know from that point, and Babu Somyo at some point and read minutes of March 2019, from that point and from the processes that have been undertaken by law enforcement of South Africa to today, what is it that's been done and how far are we? I agree that you have no business mentioning people that are under investigation, but we ought to also know what is it that is preventing you to unearth the people involved for this long. Because this thing comes way, way, way back. It's now over 3 years, and we still cannot know exactly who is involved. We must know that in South Africa, we are in a country where certain races are treated differently from other races. You would see even now with law enforcement what's happening, that during COVID, when everything was shut down, how black people were dealt with by law enforcement and then how white people were dealt with by law enforcement. Now, we don't want to get to parliament processes and our oversight then apply the very same thing that we know. We cannot keep the issue of Stanov on a standby for far too long, and it's an ongoing thing. It should be at some point finalized. So I agree, Chair, we need to sit down and understand what are the stumbling blocks. Why are we not knowing who are the culprits to this date? And I'm not comfortable in DPP when you say you do not foresee the stain of management blocking you or manipulating you with the outcomes that you are driving and the investigation thereof that you are driving. Remember that the person you are investigating is Dino. The people that were managers there, you don't have any clue of the relations between the people that are involved and the people that are currently holding office. And therefore, we cannot be gullible and say they will not try tricks and not do this and they will help us. Especially where PwC is concerned, we all know the integrity of audit firms in South Africa and how they have manipulated information to the favor of certain individuals, in particular to the favor of big corporations that are led by white people. We're not going to sit here and say those things don't happen. And therefore, you cannot rely fully and tell us that their information will make your investigation to reach a desirable outcome. It cannot be. It's easy for them to manipulate information and give you exactly what will work in favor of the culprit. And therefore, we want our law enforcement to be the ones that are investigating fully and ensuring that we get to the desired outcome of our own. We cannot be the ones sealing the criminality and all the criminal elements that happened within the time of the stain of SACA, because a lot of money and a lot of workers' money in South Africa was misused. And someone has to account. So when we say corruption must come to an end and we must have impact, it doesn't mean we must have impact on small accounts. It means we must have impact even on big accounts. So I'm not buying the fact that those people are cooperating with you. They will cooperate with you, but you cannot rely on what they give you in order for you to make up the investigation and to make up the cases. And I think I heard you saying you NPA did not take the money, but I remember the minister in one of the sittings of Justice Committee tried to explain, came up with some explanation that even in Home Affairs, you take money off Home Affairs to assist you in your work. That's intergovernmental. Home Affairs is also a government that seeks to rid itself of corrupt elements within itself. But when we get to a private person whose aim is to maximize profit at whatever cost, it's not the very same thing. Intergovernmental and dealing with private corporates is two different things. Those, the two missions are not the same altogether. The other one works on maximizing profit. The other one works on bettering the lives of the people. So if it's intergovernmental, I don't see an issue, because they are the ones that must also deal with disciplinary matters, and they will help you because that's the same government with the same goal. And then now let's come back to the presentation, Chair. This presentation will have to come back as well to the very same meeting, which I hope it will be physical when it comes. Why? If you had seen the first presentation that was done here, I think it was the 19-page one, that was explained where I identified a case which was reported in 2017 and everything. It tells you the date. But this one, only at ESCOM, the component that deals with ESCOM gives us information. But that information is also not to the fullest. Because when you are accounting, you can't account to say, I have this is the case and whatnot. There is no case number. There is no referral date to where you are. Then we cannot measure your performance. Part of our task is to measure your performance as well. We can't measure your performance when a case we are given is just that we found Peter and Tom were reported to have stolen 1 million and the project was about door to door, and then the next court date is 30th March 2021, and you close it like that. It doesn't tell us anything. It ought to tell us that this is where it comes from, referred by SIU or referred by the department on this date. We started working on it on this date. These are the court dates it has been to court, and why was it postponed? Because at times it's postponed because of the failures of the department. And what we want is the impact that must be made by the NPA. So we cannot have a report that does not tell us anything about those details. When it comes to SAA, it doesn't say anything. When it comes to Transnet, it doesn't say anything. And when it comes to TERS, it doesn't tell us anything. SIU gave us a damning report, which made a lot of referrals to NPA, where prisoners were getting money, where departmental employees with personal numbers received tariffs. Those are the straightforward cases. Those are the straightforward cases where a Veronica Mende on the system with a personal number is an individual that's known working for SAPS or working for Department of Labor or Health. And that person who received money that was not supposed to be received and never returned it back has already, in terms of crime, is already under the criminal procedure. So it's things that are clear like that, and they are not telling us here on this particular report as to what terms are they talking about, who are they dealing with, when was it reported, and where it is now. I am not happy with that, Chair. It has to come back all together and be clarified clearly on what is happening. Lastly, Chairperson, on the witness protection. NGPP, we are not going to get anywhere if people that are having information are not protected, because they are not going to report it. I listened, I think last week, it was last week, Tuesday, Wednesday, to a witness who gave information on the issues of KZN, where Magaka was also part of those people who whistleblowed, and he made at his fate. That person reported the case, the whistleblower, and instead of him being protected, all his details were presented out there. Even the witness protection was a BNB of the area where he frequented, he is known, and he couldn't find himself being protected there. And there was someone from NPA, I don't know whether it was a CEO or a director, but there was a senior official on that radio show from the NPA, it was Metro, who said, you are dealing with the regulations of the witness protection in terms of strengthening the regulations and ensuring that witness protection is not what it is. You don't use the same person, you don't use their details, you try and change their physical appearance, and in terms of accommodating them, it's a place that is favorable, and it's a place that the person is not known in. Those are just the things that I am stating, which are at the bare in terms of protecting the witnesses. And if people are treated like that, no one is ever going to come forth with the information. Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you very much, Honorable Mente. It was mouthful, but the bottom line is that you agree with the Chairperson that on a matter that relates to Stenos, let us somewhat stay the matter up until we have some kind of a extensive discussion on it, something which I think we all agree on. Two, there are questions that you have asked, which I would ask the one. General Libya, are there any matters directed to yourself and MDPP, the bigger chunk is directed at yourself. And after this, we are going to adjourn the meeting. I'm afraid the chair has lost the chair, and there's a meeting which is taking place currently of the chairpersons of the various committees with the Auditor General, and therefore with somewhat in agreement with such a proposal, Honorable Mente, we'll have to find a day to deal with other substantive matters on the reports, mainly the Stain Health report. NDPP? Unmute, okay.
Thank you. Chair, perhaps I'll start with the first witness protection question. I agree completely with Honorable Mente in terms of the importance of witness protection. There's no way we'd be able to, I mentioned that earlier, if we don't have sound witness protection, a very robust framework, and also practically that's able to protect witnesses properly. In the particular case that Honorable Mente mentioned, I would please ask that details be sent to me so that I can properly consult with the witness protection people and find out what exactly happened and respond fully with regard to that particular matter. On some of the straightforward cases that were mentioned, Chair, maybe just very quickly and we may have explained this before, so forgive me if I'm repeating, but it's really important to understand that when cases are investigated in the SIU space, and then in terms of the SIU Act, they are referred to the NPA. But what happens in practice is that these matters have to be investigated, the criminal investigation, a docket must be registered, because in terms of the SIU Act, when they come across any evidence tending to indicate or show criminality, they will then refer the matters to the NPA. But the NPA has got no criminal investigative powers or investigators. So the DPCI we then refer to the DPCI, a docket gets registered, it gets investigated, and then comes back to the NPA for us to make a decision on those matters. So I think with regard to this, if we can just get details of those matters, I wasn't able to write them down. I don't know if details were mentioned, but if we can get details of these cases and we'd be able to follow up and see what the holdups are with regard to some of the straightforward cases, which I agree should not be held up. Chair, on the issue of receipt of funding from within government and from without. I hope I got the point there, but I certainly agree that there's a difference between intergovernmental assistance and receiving assistance from private sector. But as I've said before in Parliament and in other fora, that private sector assistance to government entities, not to just to law enforcement, but across government, is nothing new. And this has been going on for years and years. In the NPA, so has it, including in the NPA, where there has been the Specialized Commercial Crime Court have been set up with a lot of support from the private sector, including the Tutuzela Care Centers with regard to sexual and gender-based crimes, has been funded externally. And it continues to happen. And certainly, given the seriously constrained fiscal and financial environment that we're operating in, there is a need to engage with the private sector to assist with donor funding, to assist in many strategic initiatives that various entities, including the NPA, has, that there simply isn't sufficient funding in government to deal with. But it's important that we are able to give assurance that these matters, that the funding received does not in any way influence the decision making of the NPA or any other law enforcement entity. And so what we are in the NPA doing is we are setting up a donor oversight mechanism which will have external people that will review funding received by the NPA and will be able to give public reports with regard to these issues. So I agree this is a very important issue. We take it very seriously, and we are going to ensure that this is done properly in a very transparent way and accountable way, accountable to Parliament as well. And Chair, I agree with the comments made around the Steinhoff matter. It's understandable that everyone, including us, and we have the ability to actually move it along, is anxious for this case to be, to get to a point where, if the evidence shows there's sufficient to prosecute, that we do proceed. And it has taken a long time. It is a complicated investigation. But I must say as well that they have been, and we sound like stuck records again, and even General LeBier will confirm that there have been serious resource issues with regard to having dedicated resources, investigators that are not carrying other matters to ensure that these cases move. In fact, I recall when I first took office 2 years ago and had a conversation with the prosecutors about the Steinhoff matter, they lamented the fact that there were only three investigators, and then it was even less than that. And I know General LeBier has worked really hard at getting capacity to deal with this matter because it is so important. But there has been a lot of challenges.
Let's leave the stain-off matter because we've already ruled on it. We're going to find time. We're going to deal with it. But you can deal with other matters.
I do want to say very quickly, Chair, that the report, the forensic report, which is coming on at the end of this month, will make a huge difference in terms of moving this case forward. Thank you, Chair. I don't think that there was anything else that I needed to...
No, thank you very much. Did you be General? General?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. I think that the NDPP have dealt with the matter from us. All what we can say is that we have taken note of the comments and the direction and the guidance of the mentor. And then we will ensure that we do our utmost best to ensure that these matters can be finalized as speedily as possible. The rest of the matters, I think that the NDPP have funded. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mentor. Honorable Mentor, are you fine?
I am not mentor treatment. I'm okay, Chair, for as long as this part of the report, which is clearly not giving information, in particular where SOEs are concerned, is explained further. All the cases as they have been reported in the summary must be accounted for. Even the ones of ESCOM, you only account for 13, but you have more cases on your summary. So each and every case must be accounted for in detail so that we can hold you accountable properly. Thank you.
Okay. I'm afraid, honorable members, that term is against us. These matters are very important matters. They are at the heart of what we deal with on a daily basis. We've seen the SIU.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know if it's just me, but I can't hear you.
Can you hear me?
I don't know if it's just me.
It might be you. We have met with the Auditor General, we've met with the SIU, we've met with ESCOM, we've met with DENEL, BRASA, a number of institutions. And this kind of a report is a report which is a add-on to a number of such instances which have qualified for either investigation or prosecution. And in terms of what we expect going forward, I think the proposal which has been made by members and detailing the fact that where are we with specific matters as reported by a number of these institutions. But what we should appreciate even from yourselves, when a call is made for us to meet in this way, you take your time, you take your nerve into these areas that you ought to report on. I think we must dearly appreciate your effort around those matters. We all seek to want to see the state machinery moving further in dealing with specific matters which are of interest to find a stable government one way or the other. So from our side, thank you very much. Up until we make another call on the matters which we have made propositions to come back, but we well appreciate that at least there is some indication that things are somewhat going well towards the interests of the country. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members.
Thank you.